Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 15th of February, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, of course, Mike Robinson. And we've got an international lineup today with Mark Anderson from American Free Press and Truthhand blog. And we've also got Alex Thompson with the Eastern Approaches report. And Alex, as always, will be joining us from the Netherlands. Well, the weather variable, we've got some sunshine here in Plymouth, so we're quite happy. But apparently it's Welsh mountain weather in Surrey. I think that means it's probably a bit misty.
OK, well, let's get straight on. I had the pleasure, privilege last night of attending the an historic event, you suppose you could say, which is the premiere of Vaxxed in the UK. Dr. Andrew Wakefield was there. Reported a couple of weeks ago, of course, Vaxxed had originally intended to be shown in the Curzon Cinema in Soho. That the Curzon Cinema decided that that wasn't necessarily appropriate for them, and they cancelled it. Well, as usually happens, a better venue was found, 100 more seats. The place was absolutely jam-packed, not a free seat in the house. Well, before the film was shown, UK Column had the privilege of interviewing Andrew Wakefield. Well, what I want to do is just show a couple of minutes from that, because I have to say, Brian and Alex and Mark, the man came across to me as being totally genuine, a man of absolute integrity, I have to say, being objective about it. But let's put it in his own words, because this gives a little bit of insight into the person who's produced this documentary.
Well, firstly, there have been many times when I've thought about bailing on this, but not for very long. Like Richard Branson said, when something goes wrong, I give myself 15 minutes to sulk and then I get over it. The important thing, the thing you come to realise, is it's not about me. They make it sound like it's about me, but it's not about me at all. This is a ruthless, pragmatic attempt to contain a lie and to protect an industry's bottom line. And what motivates me is I see the next child with autism and I think, I don't have a problem. This child has a problem. This child has no voice. So get over yourself and get on with it. And it's extremely motivating. I've got 4 healthy children and I thank heavens every day for that, but it reinforces to me that I have an obligation to children who aren't in that situation. And I didn't go. Medicine presents you with choices, like life. You know, you come to a point where you can say, as the dean said to me at the Royal Free, this is not going to be good for your career if you continue this work. Entirely, the work was valid. He loved the work, but he said this is not going to be good. It was a threat, and you have to make a choice. Do you walk away and you say to the person in the clinic, I know you, what you're telling me is absolutely right and I believe you, but there's the door. Would you take your child and go and find another doctor, because this is not good for my career? And I didn't go into medicine to do that. And so once you've taken that choice, the next decision you take is to cut all the lifelines. Because if you leave yourself a lifeline, you will take it. I've seen many colleagues do that. They've got halfway in, but not all the way in. They know it's true, but they've left themselves a lifeline. And when push comes to shove, when it really gets nasty, then they will take that lifeline and leave this issue and these children. And it doesn't make me brave or clever. It's just the reason I went into medicine, and that's it. Simple as that.
Now, in the chat box, a couple of people saying that Vaxxed may be available on YouTube. Well, it may be, but what I would say to everybody is that Andrew Wakefield, his work, the people that supported him in bringing this to the UK, they need support. And so, you know, don't watch it on YouTube. Watch it via the vaxxedmovie.com website. It can be streamed from there. And make a small financial contribution, because this work needs to continue. I would also say a really fantastic well done to the people that organised the event last night, because it was very well organised against quite a lot of opposition. So thank you to them. It was fantastic. It is a fantastic film, and I heartily recommend people to watch it.
And the key to this is truth, isn't it? This man has done the work he's done. Is he allowed to present it to the wider public for them to make a judgment on it? No, he's got to be warned off, and it's got to be suppressed.
Absolutely.
To protect the bottom line, as he said.
Absolutely. Now, Mark, one of the things that was mentioned in the Q&A session after the film was shown was that Donald Trump seems to have a slightly different opinion on vaccinations than perhaps other presidents have had, just like Donald Trump seems to have a different opinion on just about everything compared to other presidents. But he has set up an inquiry, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, a few weeks ago, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was tapped to head a Trump review commission on vaccines. There wasn't a lot of detail, but RFK, a kind of liberal icon, of course, the son of the senator and presidential candidate who was shot in 1968, for someone from the so-called liberal sect to be tapped by a conservative president like Trump to be in a vaccine review commission is interesting in and of itself. But RFK is a figure in his own right. And this morning at 9:30 a.m. Eastern time at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., there's supposed to be an announcement with Robert De Niro, the actor that helped bring Vax to the fore, and RFK Jr. They're announcing at the National Press Club upping of the ante, if you will, on the promotion of Vax. And what I'm told is they're going to have a contest for researchers and writers, kind of a sponsorship. I'm not sure of the exact details, but they want to challenge writers and researchers to do more research on vaccines, and that's what's going to be announced at the National Press Club later today.
Okay, fantastic, Mark. Thank you very much for that. Everybody should watch this film. You may have a different view coming out of it, but it should at least be seen.
Absolutely. Well, we're staying on the subject, but let's come in slightly sideways. Fake news. So I got this alert sent to me this morning. It's from the Sunday Times. What are they saying? Trust us, really. We need to educate your children as to what fake news is. Children must be trained to fight fake news. So this is pretty amazing stuff now. It's quite clear that the national newspapers and the heavier weight so-called mainstream press, they are terrified. We've now got to get at the children to make sure they can't even understand what the truth is. Certainly don't want them to learn about dangers of vaccines. So this was the Sunday Times, and it's saying we need to train the children to deal with fake news. Well, what happens when we try and talk to our MPs about fake news? Have a look at this. A few days ago, I emailed my MP. Well, he doesn't really represent me, but I happen to live in his constituency, because I asked him about these two headlines, revealed the huge gaps in UK defences and the Britain's whole fleet of a nuclear attack submarines was out of action. And basically, I asked Gary Streeter if these Sunday Times and Telegraph reports were fake news or reports that accurately reflected the real state of the armed forces. I did also mention seagulls because he'd recently been involved in a meeting on seagulls. This is what he came back with. Dear Mr. Gerrish, I have never spoken publicly about seagulls, nor spoken in any debates on this subject. I chair many debates at Westminster, and one of them a week or two ago was about seagulls. I do not choose the subject for debate. So he got a little bit shirty because he chaired that meeting and I said it was a pantomime. But this is the really nasty bit. He then attacks me personally on wider issues I have known of you for two decades or so, and during that period have learnt not to take any of your comments on any subject seriously. Sorry to have to write to you in such stark terms, but you have brought it upon yourself. Best wishes. He doesn't even sign his name. So you ask your MP serious questions about whether this is the state of the armed forces or it's fake news, and he does not want to answer the question. And why does he not want to answer the question? Because he can't, because it is the state of Britain's military. He knows it's the state. And locally, we are heading rapidly to the closure of Devonport Naval Base. And when that happens, of course, more and more job losses.
Yeah, so that's you told Brian. And of course, because he didn't have an answer, he had to resort to personal attacks.
A personal attack, yeah, absolutely. Now, let's have a look at what somebody else has, how somebody else has fared. This is a letter that a lady has received from Sarah Wollaston, having got in touch with her to speak about Melanie Shaw. And basically...
We should just say Sarah Wollaston, MP for...
The Totnes area, yeah. In South Devon. But she was a doctor. She's sitting as chair of the health committee, so you would expect her to be pretty hot on the subject of failure of health treatment. So the letter was originally about the suffering of Melanie Shaw in prison, where, of course, she did not receive proper health care. So Sarah Wollaston says here, the remit of the Health Committee is to examine and scrutinise the policies, expenditure and administration of the Department of Health and its associated bodies. I'm therefore not able to comment directly on this case. And unfortunately, there's nothing further I can add to the letter from Peter Clark. Now, I don't know what was in that Peter Clark letter, but she ends, I'm sorry, I cannot be of more help to you. So that is, I can't do anything. So if we just follow this through very quickly, NHS England has got the responsibility for healthcare in the Justice Circuit, Health and Justice Clinical Reference Group. Now, if you look at the vision NHS England sets out, it's not to provide people with healthcare, it's to operate as a catalyst to support what good looks like. What sort of language do you think that is, Mike? Newspeak with a vengeance? It's pretty amazing, isn't it? The vision is not to provide proper clinical care. It's to support what good looks like. I'll leave you to think about that. Encourage you to go to their website, because here under scope and service, you can see that they are clearly responsible for the quality of healthcare within the wider justice system. And here's the Common Select Committee, Health Committee, and their role is absolutely to look at the policy, administration and expenditure of the Department of Health and its associated bodies. So if we follow this through, this is what these MPs are doing. They're representing the parties, they're not representing constituents, but we've got the Health Committee, which is there to monitor the performance of health provision through the Department of Health and also through the NHS. Here's NHS England, responsible for the Health and Justice Clinical Reference Group. So they're looking after the prisons, and the prisons should be looking after prisoners such as Melanie Shaw. But Melanie Shaw, of course, ended up with a particularly vile leg ulcer, untreated. What then happens? The prison says it's not our responsibility, it's NHS England. NHS England says, well, we commissioned the NHS prison service, but we're not really responsible. And then if we now go to Sarah Wollaston, she says, as chair of the health committee, it's not my responsibility either. And if we follow it back to the health committee, they say they can't take evidence from individual cases. So how do they collect evidence, Mike?
Well, they can't.
Well, they can't. And in any case, they're not taking evidence now, and they're certainly not taking evidence today because they're all on holiday. But if you look at the website, what they encourage you to do is to have a look at this little video, a little cartoon video, which explains what they do. So I hope that's made it clear. We're now seeing our MPs, they're working for the party. They're not interested in what's going on in the country, whether it's vaccinations, health or conditions in prison. They're simply out for their own interests.
Now, fake news. And last week, Patrick Henningsen and I recorded a special episode of Insight with Robert Stewart, the lone campaigner on the biggest, probably the biggest fake news story ever, which was the 2013 news reports and documentary, Panorama documentary called Saving Syria's Children. So we had a little dig into that. For an episode of Insight, that's going to be shown on the live stream immediately after this programme, so stay with it.
Excellent.
Okay, Alex, Defence Minister's meeting, I'm going to bring you in on this one. So today is the beginning of the Defence Minister's meeting with NATO, mainly about the North, mainly North Atlantic Council meetings. But of course, Michael Fallon will be there. So this is the first of the year and the first chance for NATO's allies, including Michael Fallon, to meet collectively with the new US Defense Secretary Mattis. So Secretary Mattis knows NATO well, according to the government, from his time as Supreme Allied Commander for Transformation, a post he took up 10 years ago. But the security environment facing NATO has itself been transformed in the intervening decade, apparently. So this week's meeting is a chance for the 28 allies to take stock of the challenges and opportunities they face to the east and south of the alliance, to reinforce the transatlantic bond and to affirm their commitment to deepening that link and their wider allied engagement. So that's fantastic. That's really excellent. But east and south, I think, is the key point here, because this, of course, means Russia's borders. Now, why am I going to bring you in on this, Alex? Well, basically, today, mainly, it's meetings of the North Atlantic Council. Tomorrow, there's going to be a further meeting of the North Atlantic Council. But in the afternoon, there's going to be a meeting of the NATO-Georgia Commission at defence minister level. Now, of course, the NATO-Georgia Commission was established in September 2008, 1 month following the ceasefire over the South Ossetian War, to serve, as they describe it, as a forum for both political consultations and practical cooperation to help Georgia achieve the goal of membership in NATO. So this is all about Georgia coming into NATO. And Alex, I think this is huge because, of course, the Soros-inspired South Ossetian War, and I'm saying that because just mainly because Saakashvili was absolutely a Soros man. This is related to NATO expansion. It's such a contentious part of the world, being right up against Russia's borders, and Georgia especially. So, you know, what are your thoughts? I know I'm kind of hijacking you on this, but what are your thoughts?
Always willing to be hijacked, Mike, in a good cause. Yes, if you look, first of all, at my Twitter account, which is down on the lower third there, if you look at the pinned tweet, you will see a video which has just been uploaded for the public. Subscribers got to see it first, and we do value subscriptions because they pay for our time to research articles, by the way. So the more you subscribe, the more you get of us. That pinned tweet contains a link to a public documentary, now public version of our documentary, about Inside Eurasia. And what this is about is containing Russia. Now, I was the GCHQ officer, desk officer for that region in the time of the war. And I remember distinctly a time in about 2007, when perhaps even 2006 it began, when we as desk officers in all the British and American government agencies lost the plot. We knew that there'd been a push to appoint Georgia to join NATO, at least have a membership action plan, which is the last chance saloon before you board the NATO bus, as it were. But all of a sudden, the policy was not being driven by policymakers in any government organization we could think of. And it got down to the wire in 2008. That war really, thank God, well, it was a terrible war, but it put a spanner in the works, because otherwise Georgia would have been given, it happened slightly after the Bucharest summit, but the tensions at that time prevented, fortunately, Georgia and Ukraine from joining the NATO alliance. Now, the point here is that both Georgia and Ukraine contain separatist territories which are more pro-Russian. And Putin actually gave fair warning of this back in the Kosovo times of 2006. He said, if the West recognizes Kosovo as an independent state, we will do tit for tat under international law and recognize Abkhazia and South Ossetia, the pro-Russian regions of Georgia. And he duly did so. Not that the Western press has ever picked up on it, or even some Western diplomats. So that's the game now, is to try to lock into NATO two of these countries, Georgia and Ukraine, a large chunk of whose territory and population is absolutely set against being antagonistic towards Russia. It's particularly worrying, of course, because there is an Article 5 guarantee towards NATO member states. An attack on one is an attack on all, which, of course, the United States invoked in September 2001 to use NATO assets from Europe to overfly its territory, for example. So if anything could be dressed up as an attack on Georgia or Ukraine by those nasty Russians once they did join, we would all be pledged to invade Russia. It's as stark as that.
What is your reading of the situation in Georgia at the moment? Obviously, Saakashvili has moved on. And interestingly enough, of course, as we've mentioned before, he's moved on to the Ukraine. But Georgia itself, where are we at with the relationships around the Russian border there?
It seems that in the whole area, a kind of pragmatism is winning out. People want to trade with these countries. There is a whole generation. It's the same in Armenia and Azerbaijan, which are technically at war. A whole generation has grown up hearing that the other side are, you know, monsters who rape and kill people in their beds. But it is a compact geographical area. People need to trade, particularly across the Georgia-Russia border, which is a huge high mountain chain. But, you know, people in each side of the border are economically dependent on the other. And I think people are realizing, certainly the middle class in the capital city, Tbilisi, is not prepared to go to war anymore over Abkhazia and South Ossetia. That's been the big swing of the last 10 years. When I first went to live in Georgia, in fact, on my first visit before I went to live there in 1998, as soon as you get onto the highway from the airport to the city center, there was a great big banner across the highway that said Abkhazeti Chkweni Tkivili, which means Abkhazia is our eternal grief. That was taken down quietly sometime in the Saakashvili era. The veterans are getting older who fought against Abkhazia. And even in Abkhazia, the attitude is, you know, we don't want to be subsumed into either of these power blocks. We want to maintain some kind of independence. So I think that with some kind of prosperity taking hold and Georgia moving up the comfortable living rankings, there's going to be less and less interest in playing stooges for Western policy or Soros policy. So I think Soros is backing a losing horse here, but that doesn't mean he's not going to try.
Okay, and just briefly then, I mean, what's your take on the NATO thing? If Georgia gains membership, Russia, they're going to be pretty upset about that.
Yes, they're going to be existentially upset, even more so if Ukraine gets membership, because that's just the flank, you know, the open western flank of Russia, which Napoleon and Hitler used to invade Russia. So they're not going to stand for that. But they have many levers to pull. Russian intelligence has excellent penetration of the Georgian military and Georgian politics. And they have so many people they could set up as pro-Russians, if necessary, at the right moment. And they've got so much compromat, dirty material on all these Georgian politicians. I think they're always going to be one step ahead of the game. But unfortunately, you know, it's 10, 20 years now of this game going on in its current form. And I have no evidence that there is any knowledge, certainly at policymaking level, of what's going on. And, you know, very few visits are made to the area. So, you know, you could get a lot of people in the NATO bubble in a policy environment saying, yes, well, Georgia's met all the standards, let's give them membership, blissfully unaware of the conflagration that's going to follow.
Yes, but it's quite all right, Alex, because NATO has just produced a new frequently asked questions document, and in it they say that there is no NATO expansion and we are not running up against Russia's borders, so we're all perfectly safe. Let's move on. Mark, the other day on the column news here, we were talking about the World Government Forum, or whatever it's called. You've had a further look into this and published an article on the Truthhound website. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's very interesting. I know we have a lot of material today, but I was listening to some of the speeches, and Helen Clark, who's the eighth director of the United Nations Development Program, she's a former prime minister in New Zealand. She gave a kind of a core speech that outlined the basic outlook behind the World Government Summit. There's those words, world government, something we've been told for decades could never exist, doesn't exist, never has existed. But now, in the wake of the World Economic Forum in Davos in January, it's coming out that, yes, all along, we've been wanting a world government. And yet, Helen Clark said this at the Dubai World Government Summit, quote, we're now for global governance. And I put in my column, I put, she announced this as if full support for world governance is just now coming into being. We're now for global governance. And so there's this strange kind of language like that where they're dancing around the concept of world government, and yet they're basically admitting it. And then she went on to explain all these rather contradictory things about sustainable development and all the things that the UN wants to do that are as pure as the driven snow. But I'm kind of reading through my article here. She's basically saying, however, that in the peace and security realm, quote, effective global governance is struggling, she admitted, in peace and security. And so she wants to reinvigorate the UN's mission to get at the root causes of conflict and war. And one of those root causes, she said, is poverty. However, she said that the great thing about the UN and the Bretton Woods institutions like the IMF and the World Bank and the World Trade Organization. The great thing about this alphabet soup of agencies is that they've got our best interests at heart in this world government, and we can depend on them through all these multilateral institutions to tackle poverty and get rid of poverty as a chief cause of war and misery and conflict. Failing to note, however, that the IMF and its revolving loan schemes and all its debt schemes, and the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman by the author Perkins has brought this out, the IMF is a chief promoter and cause of poverty. So once again, the sheer hypocrisy of this multilateral approach of this world government, where the very institutions that it promotes cause the very conditions which bring about war and conflict, and yet we're told that these same institutions is the ticket to paradise.
Well, and I mean, what's your thoughts about the overall agenda? Are they meeting their deadlines at the moment?
Well, that's hard to say. There's an awful lot of material coming out of this Dubai World Government Summit. That's its literal name, as you guys have already reported. They're clearly behind schedule or beginning to kind of lose their tempo a little bit in some areas, particularly the peace and security realm. She admitted it's struggling. But of course, they put their best face forward. They try and put the best patina on this that they can. It's really hard to say if they're behind or on schedule in all these multilateral areas. But clearly, they're looking for a validation. She was talking about how if the UN and these multilateral institutions, if they don't progress in the way they want, they're going to lose their legitimacy. They're going to lose their image in the face of the public, and they're going to have to struggle to get their legitimacy and their dependability back, you might say. So they're very worried about losing face in terms of public opinion, and that's very clear. And there's still admissions, just like there was in Davos in January, that globalization is weakening a bit. But at the same time, she's saying, as I noted, we're now for global governance, again, as if it's a new thing. And they're trying to regain their credibility and move this thing forward in the wake of Brexit, in the wake of Donald Trump's election, when they know that populism and a more grassroots democratic view is coming into the picture and gaining strength. They're trying to regain their traction and move forward. So with Bilderberg coming up in the spring and the World Economic Forum just having wound up, and now we have this Dubai summit, we're going to see a lot of activity from these leading globalist groups to try and move forward, not lose their traction and keep their credibility and keep their agenda on track. But we are seeing, you know, they're losing some ground and they're trying to regain it. That's the basic bottom line.
Alex.
Yes, I just wanted to say that when you featured this Dubai-hosted World Government Summit the other day, Mike, I noticed the Arabic on the board in the background with the syntax being a bit different than the English, and I've just looked it up. The Arabic title for this summit is Al-Qimmat al-Alamiyat lil-Hukumat, which means the World Summit for the Governments.
Right.
So it's not the same as a World Government Summit, is it? It is a World Summit for Governments.
No, that's right. But if you remember the subhead, it was all about directing future government.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not making a contradictory point here. I'm just saying that the syntax of the Arabic makes it clear that this is a summit called with the interests of government in mind. And there is, of course, a sleight of hand in that if you concatenate it in English to World Government Summit, you're saying we want world government. And if you're challenged on it, you can say, oh, no, we don't mean that at all. Look at the Arabic.
Yes.
But you can see what the mindset is.
Yes, indeed. Okay, Mark, let's move on to General Flynn then. What's your reading on this?
I'll make a quick comment. When Helen Clark said, we're now for global governance, I think that sets the record straight. And she, again, talked about the core mission of that summit. And there is that kind of Orwellian doublespeak that you mentioned with the Arabic and the English. Now, with General Flynn, this is a very, he's the national security advisor under Trump, the top one. And it was yesterday that he reportedly resigned in the wake of all these allegations where he is being seen as being at the center of having talked to the Russian ambassador to the United States, and all these things are filtering through that Flynn was trying to undermine the U.S. relationship with Russia and a whole manner of things. It's really blowing up in Trump's face. And I think the media and the liberal Democrats and some of the neocon Republicans, they see a General Flynn, Michael Flynn, as the first head on the wall, their first trophy in attacking Trump in a very direct way. And I'm just going through an item here.
So something I was
reading on Global Research talks about that in the latter days of the Obama administration, right before Obama left, there was those 35 Russian diplomats that were dismissed and sent out of the United States over the unfounded allegation of Russian interference in U.S. elections. And some analysts are seeing Obama as having preset the dials, using the long-term lies peddled by the media and setting that basic foundation. So when Trump stepped into the White House, that claim that Russia has been hacking our elections and all manner of skullduggery, that claim had time to be well established. Then the diplomats were expelled. So that created a more hostile climate and environment that was set up for Trump as kind of a trap. And now, General Flynn is the first casualty in this media war on Trump and so on and so forth. And a lot of people are concerned. Some analysts, such as Michael Savage, a well-noted conservative radio show host here, and an analyst on Global Research and others, they're concerned that with Flynn having resigned, now the Trump opponents will smell blood and they're going to go for more. And there's concern that they're going to try and topple or seriously injure other leading cabinet members and leading officials in the Trump administration. It's a big issue. There's a lot that you could say about this, but that's the thrust of it.
But the attacks just keep coming. So Washington Post saying the economy under Trump planned for the worst. You're not going to get the worst.
Oh yeah, that's the piece by Lawrence Summers. That was linked through the Trilateral Commission website. The Trilateral Commission is, of course, that sibling to Bilderberg, and they publish trilateral members in the news at trilateral.org. And then when you click those links, it shows all the op-eds that the Trilateral members strategically place in different op-ed pages and different newspapers around the country and around the world. And that's the former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers, who once headed Harvard University. He's warning of all this dire, all these dire predictions if with Trump under as president, these dire economic predictions. And the idea is that everything Trump is going to do pretty much is going to backfire, even though we may get the impression that Trump, as a wealthy businessman, is going to be good for the economy and stocks are going to go up and everybody's rice bowls will be full and everybody will be happy, a chicken in every pot. What Summers is actually saying is that all these tariffs are going to be, if Trump institutes tariffs, that's going to be highly damaging to the economy. Well, there's a lot of literature going way back, including a former General Motors executive that I knew for years, Gus Stelzer, who was an expert on free trade and tariffs. Tariffs also can have a very good effect in that they can give a strong incentive for a country to rebuild its industry and rebuild its wage base and its salary base and its economic muscle, because it makes it too expensive to do too much outshoring and then ship the stuff back into the U.S. market. Plus, tariffs are a could be a significant source of income for the U.S. For the first 125 years of the U.S. Existence or so, tariffs were the chief source of federal income. So Lawrence Summers arguing that the economy could be very, very bleak, maybe a short uptick, and then it'll be a downhill slide under Trump, is a very weak argument for Mr. Summers. Tariffs could play a very significant role to raise more revenue at the water's edge and help the industrial might of the U.S. make a comeback. So this is just more trilateral propaganda disguised as just another column in a mainstream paper.
Yes, indeed. Okay, let's move on to European issues now. And Alex, Netherlands holding elections.
They're one of many European Union member states holding parliamentary elections, and some have head of state elections as well in 2017. And of course, the chatter is, are we going to see Brexit and Trump spread onto the continent? Well, there was already a tremor of that with the Italian referendum late last year. But what's important about this is that the slide you showed was about the refusal of the two traditionalist parties, very different parties, by the way, but the two sort of right of centre traditionalist ones. They refused to join in the debate on RTL, which is a vast pan-European establishment consensus organisation, RTL. They were going to host, their Dutch arm was going to host a debate between Prime Minister Rutte and his Liberal Party, Geert Wilders, the insurgents, shall we say, the Freedom Party guy, and four of the parties which are polling a bit less strongly. So you've got to have a six-way. At the last minute, RTL said, though, we've unilaterally decided because there's not much between the five other stragglers behind these top two, that we're going to have a seven-way instead with five cultural Marxist parties and you two instead of four. And both Rutte and Wilders, who hate each other's guts, by the way, they said they'll never be in coalition with each other, but the two front runners for the poll, they said, well, we're walking then. So instead, RTL is going to press ahead with this debate. I think it's the Sunday at the end of February, and it's going to have only five minor cultural Marxist parties and not the two front runners. So that's RTL's sense of priority. Now, we have a slide here illustrating what's happened in Dutch politics. And the two last elections for the Tweede Kamer, which is the House of Representatives, the lower house here, you can see the dramatic, you have to be a bit careful with the colours, but you can see the dramatic swing. Green in the Netherlands actually represents the Christian Democrats, the equivalent of the Tories. And everywhere that was nominally Catholic or Protestant, everywhere, in fact, except the big cities and the far north, which are both historically socialist areas, would vote for the Christian Democrats because they were a consensus party of both Catholic and Protestant areas. Look what happened the year after I came to the Netherlands, 2010. All of a sudden, the Liberals, the VVD, Mr. Rutte's party, has taken the lead because the Christian Democrats, like our Tories, proved to be about as conservative as a guy holding a Molotov cocktail. So they only cling on in sort of rural Catholic areas in the east. That's the only green bit left. So we've had a splintering of Dutch politics. And instead of two or three front runners, the old Volkspartij and People's Parties, you've suddenly got seven or eight parties and a lot of other minor ones snapping at their heels. It's maybe admirable of RTL to say we'll have all these guys at the table, a bit like with the Scottish election debates with all these previously minor people like the Green Party. But the point is, you know, it's a lot of noise and you can't hear the front contenders anymore because all these guys are on the podium. Now, you might have put something on the Stories We're Watching section on the front page of UK Column website, which is always worth looking at. And it links to an article which, if you put it up here, tells us about four kinds of dystopia. And the one that I want to draw your attention, based on Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, is the second paragraph. The Huxleyan way of controlling people is this: rule by democratic totalitarian systems, excess of choice, limitation of access to speech platforms, assimilation of minorities, belief in emotional morality, imagination and flexibility, and control by desire, debt, and implicit threat of violence. No overt control of dissent. The system selects for system-friendly voices. And it goes on about sexuality, which is a big theme in Brave New World. But the final point is, in the Huxleyan model of tyranny, you have control of thought by implicitly enclosing language within professional boundaries, which it calls Lenin-style newspeak or uniquack. So I think, you know, we're talking here about the Overton window, which is shrinking, the allowable window of discourse. So the plethora of new parties, of which the Netherlands is a good example, but it happens all over Europe, even in Britain now, particularly Scotland, Wales and Ulster. That is a kind of a false diversity. You know, it's seven shades of cultural Marxism, as far as I can see. Mr. Wilders, I don't agree with, but at least he's saying we need to think again about the basis of the Netherlands. And Mr. Rutte, the largest and somewhat conservative prime minister, is being done out of his own debate here by sleight of hand by RTL, which isn't even a Dutch company. It's pan-European.
Mm. I'll just add a bit of emphasis on that. All of us at the moment seem to be homing in on language, the use of newspeak, government reports where it's difficult to see what the sense is. David Scott is picking this up as well. I think it's going to have to be one of our key areas of research to show how language is being manipulated to help this political agenda.
Well, let's look at the manipulation of language and bring in our old Nick Clegg here, who apparently seems to be speaking multiple languages, Dutch, French and Spanish. Alex and had this to say, dear Dutch and Belgians in Britain, I don't agree with Westminster Parliament's vote on Article 50, so I'll be supporting your right to stay no matter where your home is. No government has the right to take it away.
Well, I just transcribed the Dutch remarks there. He says similar things to the Spaniards and French speakers. I didn't realise his Dutch was that bad. He gets the gender of every noun in that 1.5 minutes wrong, but never mind. What he's trying to do is obviously virtue signalling. We have a word for this kind of behaviour now. But, of course, he's confusing several matters of common law, international law, treaty obligations. Your home is one matter, but your citizenship is another. It has always been open to members of the EU, despite the passport which says the European Union on it when they came to Britain, so they were allegedly a citizen already. It was always open to them to seek citizenship. I know that heartrending stories of people who by marriage have got multiple nationalities in one household and now they feel threatened. But I'm afraid the only entitlement you have to be in a country is if you seek citizenship. That's what you do when you move to another country, whether or not there is a supranational umbrella which could disappear at any moment. A lot of people have not availed themselves of it. According to one Facebook group, they call themselves the 3 million who suddenly have no right to remain. But the way to get right to remain is to seek citizenship. And, you know, he's tugging people's heartstrings here, Clegg, by saying, poor British government to destroy your homes. But I'm afraid people have, you know, what they've been lulled into is maybe partly media, partly laziness, partly lack of choice or money or whatever. But the only way that you secure your home and your right to stay in a country is by becoming a citizen. Yeah. So you can see how much destructive power of language is at work here.
Yes. OK, well, let's move on to the European Union and potential breaking apart of it. But before we do that, Jean-Claude Juncker, this article in Sky News, Jean-Claude Juncker doubts EU unity during Brexit talks. Well, Alex, this article only really covers half of what he says, because you also pointed us to the origins of this from this German newspaper. And I just wanted to highlight this particular quote from it, because he said, people are saying with Trump on the scene, Europe's time has come. I doubt that, because unless there's much more severity, the British will manage to bring division between the rump, the 27 member states. We shouldn't actually be allowing the British to do what they're already doing, acting as if they had sovereignty to sign trade agreements with other entities, which are not allowed to do so. Which they're not allowed to do. As long as the UK is an EU member state, trade policy is the competence of the EU and thus of his commission. So Sky News wasn't reporting that little snippet.
He was not. They were not reporting the bit in which he was talking. Well, he's a Luxembourger, which is a dialect of German, his native language. But he was giving this interview in German, it seems. And they're not reporting the bit in which he said the British are not permitted to do this, because I think that would be a bit too close to the bone. So if you look at the headings in this Deutschlandfunk version, which is, you know, on the continent, they actually give you the wording of what people say. An interview is actually, question, answer, which we rarely do in the English speaking world. We should do more of it because it gives much less wriggle room for people, for journalists to dress things up and leave things out. Juncker says the headings he's been given here are, we are not proud enough of Europe. The institutional cowardice of heads of government, by which he means the sovereign members of heads of government of EU member states. The Greeks have made many reforms. The British will divide EU member states from one another, play divide and rule. So all of these headings have not made it to the Sky write-up. So you cannot trust any kind of British media write-up of a continental interview or any foreign language interview. You have to go, at the minimum, you have to use a machine translation to find out what's being left out.
I'm really shocked to hear that. Isn't that why we have BBC monitoring? We have whole teams of people to know what people are saying in foreign nations. Could the BBC be distorting the truth?
Well, I assure you, Brian, the quality, it's being slashed now, but the quality of BBC monitoring and, of course, the CIA equivalent, the Open Source Centre, historically known as FIBIS, FBIS, is very good. They did full gists or full translations on request as well. And you know, it's absolutely down the line. But that, unfortunately, that is a product not available to the taxpayer who funds it. It's only available to government and selected NGOs and hangers-on.
But, Alex, The Guardian here, the headline is Plans for Two-Speed EU risk split with peripheral members, and they're saying countries likely to be outside the core, such as Poland, fear that the inner group could start to take unilateral decisions with continental-wide effect. They are aghast at the first draft of the Rome Declaration made no mention of the nation state and are wary of an EU with an integrationist group at its core.
Well, what we've got here, I've got to compress it because we're running out of time, but on the 60th anniversary of the Treaty of Rome, the 1957 treaty, which young mandarins in Britain wanted to sign, but we weren't allowed to go and negotiate because we still had patriots at the helm, that 60th anniversary is now being re-commemorated. But we're back to this core of les six, as the French used to call them, the Benelux three, France, Germany and Italy, the countries in which historically dreamers and large conglomerates have said we need to have post national, supranational government. That tradition, thank God, doesn't exist in the British Isles, or indeed in Iberia, or indeed in Eastern and Central Europe, which has been taken over by waves from all sides, sometimes Swedes, Russians, sometimes Austrians, Germans, sometimes Turks. So in the core of Europe, you've got this six who are trying to reassert the old EEC, which they should have stuck with, really, and never brought the rest in. A kind of mini Charlemagne empire. Note it's exactly the countries where Charlemagne was emperor in the 9th century. So this goes back a long way, this trend and this cooperation with the Vatican. What you've got in the centre of Europe is these countries called the Visegrad Alliance, Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia and Hungary. And they are determined to remain independent because they've seen the horrors of being taken over by all of these other power blocks in turn. And that is the annoyance at the core of this, is now that the British have left, we, the core Benelux, Italy, France, Germany, we mustn't allow these naughty Eastern Central Europeans to think that they can get their sovereignty back. That's what's driving.
And that's why we have to tackle, the EU has to tackle Poland's bad behaviour.
Yes, EU observers carrying this, Breitbart News also picked it up. But the guy writing is simply a Sorosite. He's the social justice manager. I don't think that's quite his job title, but that's what it comes down to. The social justice campaigns manager for Human Rights Watch, a core Soros asset. And he's saying we must smack Poland's wrist hard, naughty Poland.
Okay. Look, Alex, we'll just move on to this one. EU naval operation fails to stop Mediterranean. Sorry, I've got that slide a bit messed up. EU naval operation fails to stop Mediterranean migrant traffickers. This is French MPs talking about this. There seems to be a recognition, as you say, that Euronav 4 is a scam.
Yes, for those who haven't been following it, if you look at the tweets which David Ellis puts out, and his tweet is strategic defence, all run together, but with no E on the end. If you look at that, he's been interacting on Twitter with the Commander General of the Royal Marines, who has been tweeting almost every other tweet. His EU NAVFOR is a great thing. EU NAVFOR is the best thing since sliced bread. My Marines are saving the world against piracy in EU NAVFOR. And now finally we've got Radio France Internationale, including a full English translation, which you put up on the screen if people want to read it, with French MPs and others saying EU NAVFOR has cost hundreds of millions and nabbed about 100 people. Where's the money going? Is this all for show? So the French have worked this out now.
Yeah.
It's very interesting to see it all come unravelled. Do we say, Mark, just 20 seconds on any closing remarks you'd like? I'm sorry we haven't been able to include you a bit more, but the time's gone very quickly today.
Well, I mean, a lot could be said. I think it's very important what Alex is talking about, to watch what's going to happen in Eastern Europe to see if they'll take up the same spirit as Brexit. But clearly, in terms of wanting to leave the EU, but clearly the process of Britain actually leaving the EU is being stymied again and again and again. Juncker's remarks clearly show that they're very hostile toward the idea of Britain leaving. And so we're going to have to wait and see, I think, on this show especially, just how long, if ever, it's going to take for Britain to actually literally and tangibly leave the EU under Brexit. I know you guys are saying it's going to take a long time if it ever happens. It's looking grimmer every day in a lot of respects. So I would just say that's something we're going to have to continually monitor. And Juncker's remarks certainly underscore the overall picture of what's going on and this ongoing struggle.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that. And thank you, Alex Thompson. I'll just end on the fact that people are in the chat box and elsewhere are saying, what can we do about this? You need to spread the information so that the wider public can understand it for themselves. So if you're enjoying our news reports, please tweet those out, email them, get people to come back to UK Column website to watch these new news reports and talk about what we're talking about. It's very important to help spread it. And I'll also give a reminder before we finish that the 22nd of April, we've got this wonderful hall to bring people together for the British Constitution Group to talk about dealing with what is unfolding in UK today. So don't sit at home. Come and meet other people who say we're not just going to use social media. We want to be together as human beings to see what we can do about this. But there we are, the MPs simply working for parties. They're not interested in us. They are interested in seagulls and hedgehogs, quite commendable. But I think with the movement of forces towards the Russian border, we ought to have some different priorities. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back same time tomorrow.
Bye-bye.